WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC from the Aspen Ideas Festival today. And with me now is former Assistant Attorney General Viet Dinh. How do you say Aspen Ideas Festival in Vietnamese?
Aspen Ideas Festival.
That just translates as what it is. There would be a word for idea, though, wouldn't there?
There would be, yeah. It means the ideas or the bright light, same translation.
Do you think there's a different nuance to the meaning, sometimes from language to language, what we think of as, you know, a word with a concrete meaning, like idea, actually translate it as something a little different to the soul of the people speaking that language.
Right, and it's nice because when you transliterate words and concepts across cultures, you get things like this where in Vietnamese it literally means a bright thought, mm-hmm. which encapsulate the physical aspect of an idea as well as the conceptual.
So how do you say it if something's a bad idea?
a bad, bright thought.
Something could be bright and bad.
Exactly.
So to further introduce our guest, he was Assistant Attorney General for the United States for the first 2 years of the Bush administration and is considered the chief architect of the Patriot Act. In 2006, he challenged the constitutionality of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which put new accounting rules on Wall Street after the last round of financial scandals. He teaches at the Georgetown University Law School. He left Vietnam as a child in a boat after his father was taken political prisoner there after the fall of Saigon. And Mr. Dinh, thanks formally for joining me here at Aspen.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Can we give our listeners a sense of you and your background a little bit first? I mentioned that you left Vietnam as a child in a boat after your father was taken political prisoner there. Why was your father politically incorrect after the fall of Saigon?
He was a government official in the prior administration in the Republic of Vietnam. And when a civil war ends, there are reparations to be made, and this is in this case negative reparations. And he was imprisoned. He actually escaped from the country the same day that my mother and our brothers and sisters escaped from the country. And he lived as a fugitive for 5 years under communist Vietnam. He finally made it out in 1983, and joined us in Southern California.
Wow, that's a long time. So you were separated for 8 years.
Yes, and it was the happiest day of our family when we got the telegram from the Philippines saying that he is safe in a refugee camp there.
You were what Americans called a boat person.
Absolutely. We escaped on a small boat, 15 meters with 72 persons. We ran out of food and fuel after a couple of days, but drifted for about 12 days in total, and we were finally rescued by an aid ship in Malaysia.
Did you have Malaysia as a destination, or you didn't know where you were setting out for?
Well, we knew we wanted to stay away from the Gulf of Thailand, which is where the pirates were preying on the boat people. And Singapore was an alternative, but it was a little bit too far. So Malaysia was the destination. When we first got to Malaysia, actually, the port authorities actually forced us back out to international waters. It was the beginning of the pushback policy because the refugees have worn out their welcome in these initial ports of call. And so we contemplated going to Singapore, but did not have the engine and wherewithal to do that. And so we went right back into Malaysia and sank the boat and swam to the shore.
How did you wind up in the United States?
We were admitted by the United States and reclassified as refugees. We went to Portland, Oregon on Thanksgiving weekend of 1978 to join some of our extended family who was already there.
26 years later, you designed the Patriot Act as a response to the 9/11 attacks. And I want to ask you about the legacy of that act as you see it today, including three specific controversies that still linger regarding the Patriot Act and the Constitution. First, looking back, are you at all embarrassed by the name of the act? I don't know if you came up with that, but maybe that was done in Congress. But there are arguments on both sides of many of these security provisions. by Americans of goodwill, and there were at the time. But the title Patriot makes it sound like it had something to do with being patriotic or not.
Yeah, it is rather Orwellian, isn't it? And it is I consider it to be a bit of a political demagoguery that is not necessary. The times after 9/11 were serious enough and horrible enough that the public did not need that kind of reminder of who is a patriot and what it means to be an American. When we proposed to the Congress 50 provisions after 9/11, it was called the Anti-Terrorism Act, plain vanilla, because I thought that the actions were dramatic enough that you didn't need to sex it up, as it were, in order to get the attention of the American people.
Did you say anything publicly at the time?
It was a legislative process because the Senate had its own version called the Uniting and Strengthening America Act, the USA Act. Congress, the House of Representatives, had its own version called the Providing Appropriate Tools to Restrict, Interdict, and Obstruct Terrorism Act, Patriot Act, and the final piece of compromise when we were finally getting the three versions all passed through all the houses was which name to give it. The Senate would not budge on USA. The House would not budge on Patriot. And so the final 11th hour compromise that we proposed was to name it USA Patriot Act, Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools to Restrict, Interdict, and Obstruct Terrorism. Unwieldy, Orwellian, but such is the process of law.
Yeah, and indeed. And looking back, again, are you at all embarrassed, and again, this is not your branch of government necessarily, but by the way the act was hustled through Congress after 9/11 in the nation's most fearful and psychologically vulnerable moment?
No, Brian, I'm not at all embarrassed. As a matter of fact, I'm quite proud of it because, as you recall, those 6 weeks which the Congress was doing its work, that was the only game in town. I liken it to reading War and Peace in one or two sittings rather than reading it one page at a time over a number of years. Because in a normal legislative process, Congress is working through a myriad of issues over a number of years. Here you have the entire nation focused on the fight against terrorism. You had Congress focused on passing and debating this act, and so it was quick. 6 weeks in the normal legislative process, but it was also very intense. We worked 24 hours a day. We had senators and congressmen coming in on weekends, rolling up their sleeves and working personally rather than relying on staffs and lobbyists and the like. And so I thought that it was a great example of how democracy and representative government can work in a time of crisis.
Viet Dinh, my guest on WNYC, a chief architect of the Patriot Act in the Bush administration Justice Department. So much of the Patriot Act, I should acknowledge, was not controversial. But it was controversial for a few particular things, mostly for some of the ways that it let government snoop on us without notice. For example, the so-called sneak and peek provision, which allowed the government to look into some people's homes without a search warrant. It was found unconstitutional by a federal court under the Fourth Amendment protecting us from unreasonable search and seizure. Looking back, was that a good idea?
It was a good idea because it's a very incremental change in the law that is necessary in order to protect the evidence and the safety of the people serving a judicial issue subpoena. That decision, by the way, by Judge Marrero was subsequently reversed by the Second Circuit, so the provisions as drafted and as re-edified by Congress still stands as a constitutional provision of law. What it does is it allows for investigators to come in without conducting a search to look at the survey and make sure that it is safe in order to execute a search warrant. The classic example of this is a pre-raid sneak and peek in order to insert inert materials into drums of explosive gasoline, for example, so that if and when the officers come in order to serve a judicial search warrant, there would not be a public safety factor.
Just to see if it's safe to conduct a search.
Exactly. But, like anything, I take your point. There is always a potential of misuse if there are inadequate checks and balances.
And the incident that brought the case to court was the FBI using sneak and peek to secretly search the home of Brandon Mayfield, who was wrongly jailed for 2 weeks on suspicion of involvement in the Madrid train bombings. The U.S. government subsequently apologized to Mayfield. But look, you came from Vietnam without those kinds of search and seizure protections. Is that the America we want to live in?
There's no question. From personal experience, I've seen government that does not work. either because of the oppression of the totalitarianism mm-hmm. or the anarchy of war. What we have in this country is a wonderful system of government based on laws that was challenged after by the attacks of 9/11. There's no question that we had to respond to those attacks. There's no question that by our response, we need to make sure that we preserve the ideals that make this country a great place in the first place. I think the Mayfield case is a very good example. Mistakes were made. They were not made based upon authorities by the USA Patriot Act, but simply by human error in misreading a fingerprint from the Madrid bombing, and perhaps the human error in coming quickly to judgment. But as soon as the FBI recognized its error, there are redresses, there are checks, and there are changes in procedures. And I think that is a good lesson for all of us, not only to remind ourselves that mistakes can be made, but how we deal with them in a democratic society if and when they are made.
You said not as a result of the Patriot Act, but Mayfield did choose to challenge the Patriot Act as a result of his detention, correct?
Absolutely. A very able lawyer, by the way.
Another aspect of the Patriot Act that was thrown out in court was a provision allowing the FBI to demand customer records from internet service providers and other businesses without a warrant through the so-called national security letters. And according to Business Week, about 1 million such records were obtained through these national security letters. But a court ruled that the whole thing violated the Fourth Amendment because the recipient of the subpoena could not challenge it in court.
Right. Again, some history. The national security letter concept and procedure was not created by the USA Patriot Act. It was actually part of the 1986 Electronic Privacy Act. It was an amendment to FISA. Okay. FISA was 1978. The Congress subsequently recodified it in 1993 and again in 1998 with the Anti-Terrorism Act after the Oklahoma bombings. And so the legacy of the national security letters and the issues surrounding national security letters were pre-existing since 1986. What they basically do is allow the government in a national security context to issue an administrative warrant. Instead of a judicial warrant, it is an administrative warrant that is on the signature of the FBI director alone without judicial check, because it's in the national security context. What the USA Patriot Act did, Brian, was actually put in judicial procedures in order for third parties to challenge such national security letters. That doesn't mean that the problem is not there, but it does correct a misperception in the public's mind that the only thing the USA Patriot Act did was to create an inexorable expansion of governmental authority. I think what we did there was we looked at a long history of counterterrorism operations and authorities and see where the fixes needed to be made. We did know that the use of NSLs, the national security letters, would increase tremendously after 9/11, and so we wanted to put in the checks necessary to make sure they're not abused. And I think that...
So you're saying the Patriot Act actually required judicial oversight of those FBI letters rather than enabled the FBI to do them without a court warrant?
No, what the USA Patriot Act did was gave the recipients an opportunity, a mechanism to go to court to challenge them. It does not require the courts to do anything, obviously, because that's up to the court's judgment. But prior to the provision of the USA Patriot Act, it was unclear whether or not recipients or third parties would be able to challenge these types of national security letters. And the challenge was made, and the question then became how broad were these national security letters. Now, there is a very good lesson. There's no question from the evidence of a report in 2005 of the FBI that national security letters were abused. They were horribly abused, and the FBI discovered it through a whistleblower and came to Congress and to the public and came clean on it. I think that was a black mark in the Department of Justice's eye, and certainly in the Federal Bureau of Investigations. But they're cleaning it up, and hopefully they will not recur in the future.
All right. One more Patriot Act provision, the one allowing indefinite detention based on secret evidence of any immigrant who the Attorney General believes might commit a terrorist act. Is that an accurate description of the provision, and is it still in place?
There is a pre-existing provision in the 1998 law responding to Oklahoma that allows for essentially the terrorism courts for classified evidence for immigration purposes. It did not work because of a number of administrative and constitutional problems inherent in such a secret court system. Instead, what Congress did was to make a provision for the case where a person would otherwise be deportable. And so there was an independent basis to deport that person. When there is such an independent basis, then the Attorney General, pending deportation, can indeed hold that person simply on a certification that he or she is a national security threat. And that's based upon classified evidence. You're right, but it is not a basis to exclude or deport a person. It's only basically to protect the public safety in the process of deportation.
Now, the nation has debated indefinite detention based on secret evidence a lot recently with respect to Guantanamo. But that's mostly about suspected foreign terrorists picked up on battlefields in Afghanistan and things like that. This involves immigrants in the United States. You were an immigrant, a boat person. Someone could have thought that about you here or in Malaysia. Wouldn't you have wanted a chance to prove your innocence to a court or to be released?
Yes, that's a very, very, very good point. Certainly from a personal perspective, my background, my history, my experience gives me a special concern and a special recognition for the values and ideals of our society. At the same time, we recognize that we need to do what is necessary to protect America after 9/11, including to the present day. The key difference with the Guantanamo Bay detention and the provision that we were talking about is that these are detention pending deportation. There's an independent basis for deportation.
These are people already ruled deportable.
Or pending a ruling of deportation on an independent basis of deportation.
But the government could be considering whether or not to deport them?
Yes, but there are procedures where you have to go be a judge in order to get deported. The only time where it is potentially indefinite, and it's only a potential, a slight potential, is where the country where you the person would be deported to would not accept that person. And so, or that person, or if it's a country like Somalia, where there is no government to be able to
yes.
be deported.
How many people do you think have actually been, have there been cases involving under this provision?
You know, I remember the numbers at one point. I don't know what the current number, but they're not. It's not a dramatic
dozens,
number.
Dozens, yeah, hundreds.
Yeah, I think it's under 50s, but probably the last time I looked at it was about 2003, which is 38, and I suspect that number has gone down significantly.
More with Viet Dinh coming up in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We continue with former Assistant U.S. Attorney General Viet Dinh. Now, getting away from the Patriot Act, I want to ask you about your involvement in the suit challenging Sarbanes-Oxley in 2006. You sued to get that declared unconstitutional. That was the law that was designed to place new transparency on accounting practices after the Enron and WorldCom and other accounting scandals of about a decade ago. Your case, as I understand it, challenged the constitutionality of a nonprofit board that the government established to set auditing requirements and then monitor the accounting firms that audit public companies. You lost that case. What part of the Constitution did you argue it violated?
Actually, the case is still pending. The Supreme Court just granted certiorari, so they will listen to the case and the arguments next year.
Okay.
So I suspect you and I will have this conversation next year.
Maybe.
Also.
And you can talk to Stephen Breyer about it here at the festival.
Well, no, it is pending before Justice Breyer. I would not be so presumptuous. But he is a smart man, and he knows the Constitution very well. And this is a fairly straightforward challenge. It is a challenge based upon a separation of powers and the Appointments Clause under the Constitution. And the concept is very clear. The Appointments Clause requires the heads of departments to be appointed by the president or by the courts of law. Here, the appointment of this public accounting board, the PCAOB, PCAOB is the technical name for it, is not made by the president nor even a head of the department. It is made by the SEC chairman. who is the chairman of an independent regulatory commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission.
So appointed by the president down that chain, right?
Ultimately down that chain. And so that's why you have two aspects of the argument, which is, one, the appointments clause, which is the chairman of the SEC a legitimate head of a department? And then the second, which is the separation of powers point, is, does this board, which has prosecutorial powers to investigate and disbar and levy fines against accountants, is this board an essentially executive function that needs to be ultimately under the control and supervision of the president, rather than two or three steps removed from his direct supervision? And it is I think it goes to the heart of our system of separation of powers. While none of us have any, and the lawsuit itself does not speak to the substance of Sarbanes-Oxley, I think that the institution of the separation of powers and the checks and balances that the Constitution provides in there is important enough, certainly important enough, that the Supreme Court now is taking the case for the next term.
So you could argue it on a constitutional abstract separation of powers basis, but of course this was pushed forward by the industry that didn't want this kind of oversight. You filed this in 2006. Do you see it any differently today after we just went through this financial meltdown that I think most people agree was caused in part by too lax oversight by the SEC? And is it a good time really to push the Supreme Court to try to weaken oversight of accounting transparency?
That's a very good point, well made. However, I think it's a little bit misdirected. The accounting industry actually very much opposed this lawsuit because they were very happy with the new regime instituted by Sarbanes-Oxley, requiring auditors and accountants to verify everything.
And they knew what the rules would be?
They knew what the rules would be. It would give a clear provenance for the major accounting firm.
But forgive me if I'm mistaken, but Wall Street didn't like it, right?
No, general. I frankly don't know what the view of Wall Street was. The lawsuit here is actually brought by several nonprofits. All of us are working pro bono on the case, and it was quite hard to find lawyers who would not be conflicted with the accounting profession to help us on the case. But be that as it may, I think the critical point is that we are not challenging the substance of Sarbanes-Oxley. We are challenging the mechanics with which the regulation of the accounting industry was effectuated through a mechanism which, in our mind, is a violation of the separation of powers. Even with the highest ideals and the best policies, we have to do it right.
One more topic. The Sotomayor nomination and hearings. And you went through confirmation as an assistant attorney general. What do you think about the whole process? From the selection, how the White House picks and vets nominees for that position, for your position, and then how the Senate goes about confirming.
You know, one of the honors of my prior position in the Department of Justice was the selection and the assistance in confirming judges. First of all, I think that Judge Sotomayor's life story is just literally brings tears to one's eyes when you think about it, including her graduation as summa cum laude from Princeton and success in Yale Law School and thereafter. I think the process itself is constitutional. Designed to have a bit of tension. It may not be partisan tension, but there is an interbranch tension between the executive branch and the legislative branch. I think it was very good, not only politics and policy, of President Obama to reach out to congressional leaders on both sides of the aisle to take their input. You know, whether or not he gave them any credence is a different matter, but just simply listening to the leaders, I think, helps solve that process. I think there will be significant questions to be asked of Judge Sotomayor regarding her structural emphasis on interpretation of the Constitution, how she views empathies, for example, how she views group rights versus individual rights. But these are all very legitimate questions to be asked, and she is very capable. I'm sure she will be answer them very well and be confirmed by the Senate. I liken the process to investing. You want to be a long-term investor like Warren Buffett. You don't want to be a short-term speculator like Ivan Bolsky. You don't want to focus on what a judge would do in particular cases and try to speculate as to what he or she would rule in your favor. You want to buy in for the long term, find men and women of character, of integrity, of ability.
So last question. I'm asking all our guests here at the Aspen Ideas Festival to mention any ideas other than their own that they've heard at sessions that you've attended? Anything that comes to mind for you in a session about justice or a session about nothing that you deal with professionally?
I love Justice O'Connor's focus on the public education of our children, especially with respect to civic education. And if it did not come up here, but it really should, was her appearance on TV in a comedy show announcing the formation of the ArcCourse.com, which tried to teach the role of the courts to the children. I really think that's a great idea.
All right. Former U.S. Assistant Attorney General Viet Dinh, law professor at Georgetown. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.